सहनावतु सहनौ भुनक्तु सहवीर्यं करवावहै तेजस्विनावधीतमस्तु मा विद्विषावहै ॐ शान्ति शान्ति शान्तिः
गुड
Continue in chapter 8. I'll apologize. I'm getting over a bit of a cold and my throat is a little funny. I'm feeling okay otherwise. We may abbreviate the class a little bit. We'll see if the throat holds out. We'll begin with some recitation. Starting with verse 5. Do we have the focus? Repeat after me, please. Antakale cha mameva Smaran muktva kalevaram Smaran Yah prayati samadbhavam Yah Yati nasyatra samshayah Yam yam bhāpi smaran bhāvam yam yam Tyajat yante kalevaram Tyajat Tam tam evaiti kaunteya Tam tam Saratad bhāva bhāvitaha Sarad Tasmat sarveshu kaleshu Tasmat Mamanusmara yudhyacha Mamanus Mayar pitamano buddhir Mayar Mame vaishyasya samshayaha Abhyasa yoga yuktena Chetasa nanya gamina Paramam purusham divyam Yati partanu chintayan Kavim purana manushasitaram Anoraniyam samanusmaredyaha Anorani Sarvasya dhataram achintya rupam Sarvasya Aditya varnam tamasaf parastat Prayana kale manasachalena Prayana Bhaktya yukto yoga balena chaiva Bhuvor madhye pranama veshya samyaka Satam param purusham upaiti divyam Tadaksharam veda vido vadanti Vishanti yadyatayo vitaragaha Yadichanto brahmacharyam charanti Tathe param sangrahena pravakshye Sarva dvarani samyamya Sarva Mano hridi nirudhya cha. Murdhya dhyayatmana pranam. Astito yoga dharayanam. Om ityekaksharam brahma. Vyaharan mamanusmaran. Yah prayati tyajan deham. Sayati paramam gatim. Ananya cheta satatam. Yo mam smarati nityashah. Tasyaham sulabhah partha. Nitya yuktasya yoginah. Mam upetya punarjanma. Dhukalayam ashashvatam. Napnuvanti mahatmanah. Samsiddhim paramam gatah. Very good. So, continue. Actually, with some very dramatic verses. In the last class, we finished verse 8, talking about the necessity of, you know, the verses, the last several verses basically said to that one who dies with one's mind fixed on Bhagavan, that person reaches the supreme goal. And we talked at some length about how such verses should not be mechanically interpreted to indicate exactly the nature of your last thought. We don't know what our last thought would be. The implication of that series of verses is that the condition of our mind at the end of our life is a result of everything that has preceded it. How we've lived every day, not just what do you think counts? How you live your last day or how you live every day? Makes sense, right? So our condition at the end of our life depends on how we've lived our entire lives. So these verses do talk about that last moment, but let's understand that that last moment is indeed a product of how we've lived our entire lives. Now, the chapter goes on with some rather remarkable verses. Literally, Sri Krishna here is giving instructions to Arjuna as to how to die. Literally. You'll see that as we proceed today. Of course, Arjuna isn't going to die right there and then on the battlefield, even though so many great, powerful warriors, even his equal, Karna, is going to perish on that battlefield. Arjuna will survive victorious along with his brothers, except for Karna. And then why is Sri Krishna giving him this instruction? In fact, just a general observation I should have perhaps shared with you at the beginning of the chapter. Some scholars will look at chapter 8. A long discussion about how to die and about how to deal with death. Many scholars, especially Western scholars, will suggest that this is an interpolation. Interpolation means something that's been inserted in the Bhagavad Gita. There is always a debate between very traditional scholars and more modern scholars. Very traditional scholars would take offense at that suggestion that things have been interpolated or put in. Modern scholars are surprised because when you look at both the content and even the style of language, you know, there are places in the Bhagavad Gita and other texts where the style of language shifts. If you were reading a book, and it's by like a novel by an author who's well known to you, and then suppose at three chapters in, the whole style of writing changes. Do you think you'd detect that? Do you think three chapters in is a chapter written by some other well-known author, not the one that you're reading? Do you think you could detect it? Of course. It's a significant change of style. So many modern scholars will observe that there are similar sections of the Bhagavad Gita where the nature of the language shifts somewhat. Mostly, of course, the grammar is very simple throughout the Sanskrit grammar of the Bhagavad Gita. It's all meant to be very simple and accessible, not scholarly. But some scholars have observed that the vocabulary used, the choice of words used, does vary considerably from one place to another. And here the traditional scholars and modern scholars can get into a big argument. Ultimately, you can't prove either position. You can't prove that this chapter 8 is part of the original Bhagavad Gita. You can't prove that it isn't. There's no way of proving. But then we can raise a question, that does it really matter? We already know that the Bhagavad Gita is not a transcript of the dialogue between Sri Krishna and Arjuna on the battlefield. We've discussed before how these are Sanskrit verses. No one speaks in Sanskrit verses. So this is clearly not a transcript of a dialogue. These are verses composed by Vyasa, or whoever it is that composed the whole of the Mahabharata. Even the whole of the Mahabharata, 100,000 verses, do you really think that was composed by one historical person? There's no way of knowing for sure, but it certainly is reasonable to assume that there was more than one person involved in the composition of that gigantic Mahabharata. Now, sometimes traditional scholars are offended at these suggestions, but where is it the harm? Where is the disrespect? If things have been added, they've been added by great religious scholars. If the Mahabharata is a product of more than one author, well, each and every author that contributed to the Mahabharata was a great person. You know, to say that it wasn't the work of one historic individual is not doing harm to this tradition, because we acknowledge that it is a great work. Secondly, what really determines the value of any text or scripture, and we've discussed this before, is not the author, nor the origin, nor the age. What makes a text valuable, as you understand, is the content. Age is really irrelevant. You know, we start off with this thinking that anything ancient is, you know, these are ancient scriptures from the world's most ancient religious tradition, and I've joked with you before that what's old is not necessarily good, and a silly example I've given before is what? The food in your refrigerator. That which is old is not necessarily better. The same applies to Scripture. The value of these Scriptures is not in its antiquity. The value of these Scriptures is clearly in the content. Not antiquity, not even the source. You know, people have, Western scholars, just to give a different example, Western scholars have argued whether William Shakespeare, the historical William Shakespeare, actually wrote those plays. There are some people who argue strongly that some other famous poet wrote at least some of those plays. Suppose a famous Shakespeare play is demonstrated to clearly not be by Shakespeare. Does it make it a less wonderful drama? The value of that literature is the content, not the author, not the age. Pardon me. And the same must certainly be true of the Bhagavad Gita. So, consider chapter 8. A long discussion about death certainly looks out of place in the Bhagavad Gita in general. After all, spiritual instruction to Arjuna on a battlefield, can you imagine? A mighty warrior, and remember the context from chapters 1 and 2, and that is Sri Krishna is trying to cheer up Arjuna. Remember, Arjuna got very depressed, seeing that he had to fight against his own family members. So one way of understanding the entire Bhagavad Gita, in terms of the drama of the Mahabharata, the whole Bhagavad Gita is a spiritual pep talk to prepare Arjuna to fight. That's what the Bhagavad Gita is in the larger context of the story of the Mahabharata. Now, in a spiritual pep talk, would it be a good idea to talk about dying? Dramatically, it doesn't make sense. But then this is a style of Mahakavya, of these great, great works of literature, which are meant to be all-embracing. The Mahabharata was meant to be an all-embracing scripture, a scripture that includes everything, and certainly the Bhagavad Gita, being a small part of that Mahabharata, is meant to be self-contained and complete, which means it's sometimes necessary to bring in other things. It looks pretty clear that Arjuna and Sri Krishna were not discussing death out on the battlefield. It's much more likely that Vyasa, the author of the Mahabharata, decided that this material was too valuable to be ignored and should be included in this section of the Mahabharata, which we now call the Bhagavad Gita. So you can call it Vyasa's interpolation. Does that hurt? Is there any reason to be offended by such suggestions? Again, we don't know if this is true or not. There's no way of finding out. One way of saying it is, it doesn't make any difference. The content is enough to establish a validity. But on the other hand, there's nothing wrong with having a modern, realistic understanding. And some of you may feel differently, and I would respect that. My personal feeling is being excessively traditional and saying that the Bhagavad Gita is definitely the words of Sri Krishna exactly as he spoke them to Arjuna. In my opinion, to take this ultra-traditional position is possibly doing harm to the tradition, doing harm by making it look silly. When a Christian fundamentalist starts talking nonsense, when a Christian fundamentalist comes up to you and says, you know, you're going to hell. You're Hindu, right? Yeah. You're going to hell. So, when you're told that, doesn't that diminish Christianity in your view? Christianity is a great religion. I believe that. I believe Christianity is a great religion. But when somebody makes Christianity look really stupid, then that not only makes a person look small, it makes a religion look small. So maybe we should be a little careful about what we hold on to in this tradition. If we hold on to things which are a little silly, we might cause others to have that same kind of reaction. Okay, enough said. I should have made these comments perhaps at the very beginning of the chapter, but I don't believe I did. So we can treat then the bulk of chapter 8 as My preference is to think about it as Vyasa's interpolation. This is probably not discussed by Arjuna and Krishna, but probably added by Vyasa, because it's important. Okay, enough said. So, what's already been said is the importance of living a life dedicated to spiritual growth with your mind always focused on God, so that that will all be with you then at the end of your life. As we move on, the first thing we're going to notice with the next verse is a change of meter. Most of the verses of the Bhagavad Gita are in this Anushtubh Chandas, which is a poetic meter that has 8 syllables and a quarter. It changes for the next 3 verses to a meter called Trishtubh Chandas. It has 11 or 12, usually 11, occasionally 12 syllables in a quarter. And why does that change take place? If you look through the whole of the Gita, in fact, the whole of the Mahabharata, it's done for 2 reasons. One is you can express more complicated ideas if you have more syllables in a line to work with. This is poetry. Poetry being used to express very sophisticated ideas. So if your hands are tied, so to speak, and you're limited to 8 syllables in a quarter, then it's a little bit more restricting or confining. So 11 syllables gives you more compositional freedom. But more often than not, that's not the reason. More often than not, the reason for the shift of meter is it's very dramatic. At the beginning of class, you noticed as we were chanting, when we started with this verse 9, where the meter shifts, it really catches your attention. That's exactly the point. If the author, Vyasa, wants to, you know, kind of wake you up and tell you, hey, pay attention, these are some really important verses, a good way of doing that is exactly to change the... A good way to do that is to change the meter. So most of the time, the meter changes in a very dramatic moment. Here, the dramatic moment is Sri Krishna's instruction to Arjuna how to die. That's pretty dramatic. Well, let's see what he says. Kavim Puranam Anushasitaram Kavim Puranam Anoraniyan Samanusmaredyah Anoraniyan Sarvasya dhātāram acintya rūpam Aditya varnam tamasav parasthāt Not only dramatic, but even paraphrasing Upanishad. Upanishad is, you know, the very mystical, profound teachings of the rishis, which are quoted here by Sri Krishna in this verse and I think the next verse as well. Start in the end of the second quarter, Yaha Anusmaret. Actually, the sentence begins with this verse and ends with the next verse. So the sentence begins, Yaha Anusmaret. Yaha, one who... Anusmaret, remembers. One who thinks about, one who reflects upon. And the next verse is going to say prayana kale, at the end of one's life. So at the end of one's life, yaha anusmaret, one who thinks about, reflects upon who? God. How is Bhagavan described here? And so one who reflects upon God, described as Kavim Puranam, as the Puranam, ancient Kavim. Now, Kavi doesn't only mean poet. Conventionally, it means poet. It was also a word used for the rishis. So one way of understanding is Kavim Puranam, the one who's more ancient than the rishis, the one from whom the ancient sages received their knowledge. Another meaning of Kavi, and what Shankaracharya actually says, is Kranta Darshi, those who can see beyond everything. And Shankara says Sarvajnaha, one who's omniscient. So Kavi can also mean here the omniscient one. So one, Yaha Anusmaret, one who thinks about, at the end of one's life, one who thinks about the Puranam, ancient, uncreated Kavim, omniscient God, one who thinks about that omniscient God, who is Anushasitaram, who is the Anushasitra, the one who is really in control, the one who is in charge. Shas means to rule. Anushasitaram, in the accusative case, the one who rules. When we call Bhagavan, when we call him, we use words like Prabhu or Ishvara, which mean Lord, the one who's in charge. What does that mean? The one who's in control, ultimately. And in what sense? We've discussed several times that we shouldn't take the childish image of an individual being in some loka who has a human-like will. We've discussed at length that Bhagavan is in control, but without a human-like will. I will not repeat. That's a long discussion we've done several times already. So not that Anushasitaram, the one who rules, the one who governs, the one who is in control, not with a human kind of will. The one who is in control in what sense? What determines your next thought? This is a funny observation. We like to think we're in control of ourselves. If you're in control of yourself, can you choose your next thought? Go ahead and choose. Pumpkin. Now, as soon as I said pumpkin, whatever you started to think about was set aside by my utterly ridiculous word, pumpkin. So it shows we're not in control. In fact, we all live with the illusion of being in control. Now, it's true that Bhagavan has given us free will. It's true. We have free will. But how powerful is your free will? What is its range of motion, so to speak? How much are you free? Are you free? Free will means you can do anything? Can you fly? Can you eat, just to be silly and practical at the same time, can you eat just any kind of food and get away with it? No, we're not in, we're in control of a few little things. Like at home, you're in control of whatever your spouse lets you do. In the same way, Bhagavan has given us free will, but it's not that free. It's very limited. The one who's really in control is Bhagavan. And again, not that God is some willful individual looking down upon us from some remote loka, but rather Bhagavan is the intelligent, natural order of the universe. These are Pujaswami Dayananda's words. The intelligent order of the universe. The way things happen. The laws of nature, laws of karma, all of this intelligence in the universe. The way the universe works. This is Bhagavan's will at work, is intelligence at work. So therefore, Anushasitaram. Also, Anoho Aniyan. Anu means, and by the way, this is one of the scriptural quotes that comes out of several Upanishads is this expression. Anu means atom or that which is very subtle. Anoho aniyan. Aniyan is a superlative. That which is most subtle. Anoho. More subtle than any other subtle thing. The most subtle of the subtle. Now, this word subtle, if we use it in English, has a very fuzzy general meaning. You know, what do you mean by subtle? It depends on the context. But when we've used the word sukshma in this classroom, which means subtle, we've always given it a very specific meaning, right? We've never used it in a very vague, general sense. We said subtle specifically means not tangible. It exists, but you can't see, hear, taste, touch, or smell it. It's not physical. It's not a physical thing. It's a non-physical thing. It exists, but as a non-physical thing. That's what we mean by sukshma, subtle. Same meaning applies here. Bhagavan is more subtle than that. Because a subtle thing would be like your mind. Your mind exists, but not as a physical thing. Therefore, it is sukshma. But Bhagavan is more sukshma than that, more subtle than that. After all, Bhagavan is the one because of whom you possess a mind. So brain is physical, mind is subtle, sukshma, and Bhagavan is more subtle than that, being the source of your mind, anoho aniyan, more subtle than subtle. Sarvasya dhataram, the next description of Bhagavan, God, is as the dhataram, dhatra, as the one who creates, establishes, the one, again, who's in control, but the one who establishes or creates sarvasya, everything, the creator of everything. Sarvasya dhataram, the creator of everything, who is achintya rupam, you can figure out the meaning of that, the one whose rupa, form, is achintya, unimaginable. The one whose form is unimaginable. But I can imagine Lord Shiva, I can imagine Lord Krishna, I can imagine Mahavishnu, Lakshmi Devi, etc. Fine. That's not exactly who Bhagavan truly is. Achintya rupam, beyond all of those forms. All of those forms are absolutely valid for the sake of worship. But the Bhagavan, because of whom all those individual forms in which we worship God, the Bhagavan because of which all those forms exist, that God is achintya rupam, one who has no particular form, one whose form is unimaginable. Who is Aditya Varnam Tamasaha Parastat. Again, out of Upanishad, quote, one who is Aditya Varnam, who is like the, whose color, Varna, is like that of Aditya, the sun. The one who shines, what beautiful poetry. The one who shines as beautifully as the sun, Tamasaha Parastat, Parastat, beyond Tamasaha darkness. The one who shines as beautifully as the sun, standing out in the darkness of space. That's what this implies. When you see the sun out on a bright blue sky, it's beautiful. But think, I guess right now we got some astronauts working on that space station. I read some, they're doing some repair work out there. Can you imagine doing repair work floating in gravityless space, 250 miles above the surface of the Earth, traveling some thousands of miles an hour, and while they're in that condition, they're doing some repairs. Amazing. Why am I talking about this? Think about how the sun looks to them. That bright orb against a pure black background. That's what the sun looks like in space. We see it differently. So that's what this expression says. This Aditya Varnam Purusha, God who shines like the sun, tamasaha parastat, beyond darkness. You can think of shining through the darkness, surrounded by darkness, but shining. So the sentence continues in the next verse. Yaha anusmaret, the one who remembers at the time of death, Bhagavan, as described, God, as described, and the description goes on. Prayana kale manasachalena prayana bhaktya yukto yoga balena chaiva dhruvor madhye pranama vesha samyaka. Satam param purusham upaiti divyam. Okay, previous verse. One who thinks about God is basically what the prior verse says. This verse continues. Prayana kale. At the kala, at the time of your prayana going forth. At the time of going forth obviously means at the time of death. Yaha anusmaret, one who remembers God, from the previous verse, prayana kale, at the time of death, manasa achalena, manasa, you remember with your mind, manasa, what kind of mind? Achalena, a mind which is achal, unwavering, steady. The one who thinks about God at the end of one's life with an unwavering mind. Now, this sounds awfully difficult. You bet. That's why he says, bhaktya yuktaha. You have to be yukta, endowed with bhakti. Bhaktya yuktaha, endowed with great devotion. And that devotion doesn't just come apnea all by itself. Devotion is cultivated. Love is cultivated. Love for a person is cultivated, for a spouse is cultivated, for parents, children, others. Love is cultivated. It doesn't just turn on. So in the same way, love, bhakti for Bhagavan, is cultivated. When it's been cultivated through a lifetime, you become yukta, endowed with bhakti, great devotion. And how can you make your mind achala, fixed on Bhagavan? He gives instructions here, yoga balena. Because of the bala, because of the strength of your yoga spiritual practice. Because of the strength of your spiritual practice, your mind will be fixed on God at the end of your life. And to the extent that our spiritual practice has been a little floppy, shall we say? Irregular, inconsistent, not very intense. To the extent that our spiritual practice is weak, to that extent, we will be weak in our last moments. This is true in every aspect of life. You know, and they got this stupid statement, but it's true. You use it or lose it. It's stupid, but it's absolutely true. This is true with our physical bodies. Use it or lose it. That is, we better exercise our bodies and develop our strength, otherwise that strength will go away. Mind, it's been demonstrated that people who don't keep mentally active are much more likely to get this Alzheimer's. This has been established. So we better stay active. Use it or lose it. How about bhakti? Use it or lose it. Devotion. Either you are cultivating it or it is waning away. It's fading away. So here, Sri Krishna describes someone who has cultivated bhakti throughout their lifetime And it becomes, such a person becomes yukta, very well endowed with this devotion. But yoga balena, it takes practice through the strength bala of one's yoga, of one's spiritual practice. One gains that mind. Then what? Said dramatic verses talking about how to die. It says, Bruvoho madhye pranam aveshya. Samyak. Aveshya. Having caused to enter. Having made to enter. Having manipulated. What? Pranam. One's life force. Pranam aveshya. Having placed, so to speak. Having placed one's prana where? Bruvoho madhye. Bruva. Bruvoho. Singular, dual. Bruva is one, bruvao is two. Bruvoho. Between the two, madhye, in between. So, avesha pranam, placing one's life force, bruvoho madhye, in between the eyebrows. This is all part of a yogic tradition which traces the passage of life as it leaves your body. And what they're describing is a process by which it is gathered at this point, between the eyebrows, means behind, and in preparation for its final exit through this brahmarandra, through this gap in the skull, which is said to exist. So this is part of a yogic description of how the prana, life force, leaves one's body. It collects here, between the eyebrows, before it leaves through the top. And it says here that this yogi, the one who's really done a lot of spiritual practice throughout one's life, does this very deliberately, consciously. Avesha, the one who makes it happen, the one who collects their life force here, preparing to release it. Samyak, they do it well. It's done intentionally, deliberately. So what about this person? This is the most exalted yogi of all. We're describing here an enlightened person. Let's admit it. This is a description not of you or me. This is a description of a Mahatma, at least not of me, maybe of you. This is a description of a Mahatma, a great liberated soul, great enlightened person. Saha, that such a person, upayiti, reaches, comes near, reaches. Comes near what? Tam param purusham divyam. Tam, that, param, ultimate, divyam, divine, purusham, being, God. Tam, that, divyam, divine, paramam, supreme, purusham, being. So, paraphrase the prior verse and this one. The one who, at the time of one's death, reflects upon God as being omniscient, as being the creator of all, as being the one in control, the one who pervades the universe in the form of the laws of nature, the one who reflects upon that God at the end of one's life, being filled with devotion, devotion cultivated through a lifetime of spiritual practice so that it is extremely strong to the extent that your mind doesn't wander. Such a great yogi then concentrates their life force between the eyebrows, preparing to die consciously and deliberately before they release the life force. And in this way, they can reach, they do reach, the supreme God of the universe. We have one more verse in this Trishtup Chandas. Yadaksharam Veda Vido Vadanti Yadaksharam Vishanti Yadyatayo Vitaragaha Vishanti Yadyatayo Vitaragaha. Yarichanto brahmacharyam charanti Tathe param sangrahena pravakshe Prior verse is talking about the param, the goal to be reached. Para has many words. It can mean foot, it can mean goal, it can mean path, the path by which you reach. The path by which you reach a goal. And here Sri Krishna is talking about that param. Look at the last line here. Tat te param. Tat param. That pada. Now, that goal and that means of reaching the goal. Pada has both of these meanings. The goal and the path by which that goal is reached. The goal is Bhagavan. And the path by which God is reached. At the end, Sri Krishna says, Pravakshye. I will tell, it's a future tense verb, I will tell, te, to you Arjuna, I will tell you tat param, that goal, and that path to reach the goal, I will tell you sangrahena, briefly, in a summary form. So, O Arjuna, listen now, I'm going to tell you how you reach the ultimate goal. The goal to be reached after this life. That's the point. The whole context is prayana kala, the time of death. So what is the goal to be reached? And now he describes here that goal in some general words. He says the goal, tad aksharam veda vidaha varanti. The goal which veda vit, one who knows the veda, is veda vit. People who know the scriptures, Vedas. So, Veda Vidaha, and here means really not just knowing the Vedas, but having used the Vedas, having become enlightened based on Vedic teachings, Upanishadic teachings. So, Veda Vidaha, those who know the Vedas, Varanti, they say, they describe what? Yat, that goal, that param, they describe the goal as how? Aksharam. The immutable, the unchangeable. This is one of many words we use to describe God. Unchangeable. When you think God is unchangeable, immutable, these words seem so abstract, and you wonder why. Why would that word akshara? By the way, the reason it's often used for the words, some of you are thinking syllable. Because akshara, especially in vernacular languages, means syllable. And the reason for that is a syllable is that which cannot be further divided. A phonetic element which is indivisible is an akshara, syllable, a letter or a syllable. So here, we're not talking about syllables or letters, we're talking about Bhagavan, the God of the universe, who is called akshara because indivisible and unchanging. Why are these words important? They seem abstract. Consider this. You and I are constantly changing. Now, in many regards, it's a good thing. It means that we can grow to become more wise, more caring, more loving. If we could never change, that would be a shame. Imagine if we start off as children, if we can never change and grow, that would be a tragedy if we were somehow kept as children. So, we're engaged in this process of growth, which is right now a good thing, except that change doesn't stop with growth. Was it, I think, our last class or the class before, we talked about these six kinds of change? So we talked about that you are born, then you exist, then you grow, So you're born, Jayate. You know, these are the Shadvikara, Shadbhava Vikara, the six modifications. One is Jayate, you're born. Then what? Asti, you exist. Then what? Vardhate, you grow. Then what? Parinamate, you undergo some changes. Then what? Kshiyate, you decline. And finally, Mriyate, you die. You grow and you decay. Remember, that which goes up must come down. And, you know, our lives, we build up our lives, wonderful, but that definitely comes down. The philosophical observation here is anything that changes is subject to all six of these. Makes sense. These are the six kinds of change. Anything that changes is subject to all six, including decay and death. You and I are subject to all six, including decay and death. Suppose Bhagavan were to change just a little. The implication is he would be subject then to all six of these forms of change, including decay and death. Therefore, akshara, which could mean indivisible, it can also mean undecaying or immutable. And now you understand why that's such an important word. It's a little abstract, but now you understand better. So, Vedavidaha Varanti, the ancient sages who knew the Vedas, and all those who know the Vedas, they called the goal Akshara, the immutable God of the cosmos. And then he talks about some other people, talking about Yatayaha, Yati. Yati is one who strives, one who's on a life of spiritual growth. Often it's used to describe sannyasis, Hindu monks. So, yatayaha, those sannyasis, those spiritual seekers who are vitaragaha, who are completely freed from their desires and passions so that they can be devoted completely to spiritual life. What about them? Yat vishanti, they enter into that goal. So the goal which Arjuna is seeking, the goal padam, which Sri Krishna in the last line says, I'm going to tell you about the goal. In the first line, it's the goal that those who know the Vedas call that goal aksharam, the immutable God of the cosmos. Yatayaha, the yatis, the sannyasis, the spiritual aspirants, they enter into that goal, or that path, they're reaching the goal. And others, brahmacharyam charanti, perhaps the yatis also, brahmacharyam charanti, they follow charanti, or practice. What do they practice? Brahmacharyam. Now, this word is often used for celibacy. Brahmacharyam charanti, those who practice celibacy. But let's be clear. First of all, the literal meaning of brahmacharyam is a charya activity which leads you to Brahman, God. That's the literal meaning of it, activity which leads you to God. All of you have heard a lot of stress, emphasis in this Hindu tradition on brahmacharya celibacy. If you look very carefully at all of the texts that extol celibacy, you'll find that each and every one of those texts have been written by a sannyasi. A sannyasi who lives a life of celibacy. It's the life of a monk, and that's what it is. The ancient rishis were not celibate. How did they have sons and daughters to carry on the Vedic tradition? The ancient rishis were not. Nor is it necessary in any sense to be celibate to live a life of spiritual growth. It is important. It is absolutely essential that any sexual activity has to be completely dharmic. It has to be within the scope of Dharma. Any illicit, any adharmic sexual activity is absolutely an obstacle to spiritual growth, what to say of you, of anything else. But here, brahmacharyam, again, we need not take it in a very narrow sense. So the Hindu tradition is not sex negative. It's very neutral, very objective towards it. You'll bear in mind that those texts and those teachers who extol and focus upon celibacy, they're for obvious reasons. For the same reason, in fact, some of those same texts will also talk about. It's almost hilarious. I can show you some Sanskrit texts which go on and on about how foul and vile women are. Did you know that? You can find some textual passages that go on, verse after verse, and they're stinking, they're like this, they're like that, oh, horrible, terrible. And if you're reading, you wonder, what in the world is this all about? What has this got to do with spirituality? And especially in a tradition that has such reverence for women and a female principle. Again, consider the author of the text. Not only the author of a text is not only a man, but a man struggling, a celibate man struggling with his celibacy, is going to write such things, right? The fact that he should write such a thing shows he's afraid of women. Some of you know there's one in one group of Swaminarayan monks who have a policy of staying away from women. And the head of the organization, and by the way, they're very pious, and my comments are not to put them down. They are very pious, dedicated sannyasis in this group. But I've heard the story from several women who have been really hurt and offended when they went to do pranam to such a monk, and the monk said no, wouldn't let them come near. And we can all understand how hurtful that can be to a woman. You might wonder, where did this tradition come from? This particular group is a monastic group. It's a group of monks, all of whom are male in this particular group. Not that all monks are male, but this particular group. All of their monks or sannyasis are all male. And the founder and the current head is very concerned that all of the monks should stay on the right track. And staying on the right track for them means avoiding women. So suppose you as an individual or your young disciples are kind of looking at some women, how to discourage them. You write some texts like this. So anyway, when you read things like that, put it in right context. So there are certainly some anti-sex and anti-women teachings to be found in traditional Sanskrit texts. But in context, these teachings are not meant for everyone. These teachings are meant generally for celibate male monks. Enough said. So, brahmacharyam charanti, they follow a life whose conduct leads to Brahman. That's literally what it means. Charanti, they do, they follow. They follow a life which is of brahmacharyam, life leading to Brahman. And why do they do this? Yat ichantaha. Ichantaha, because they desire yat. That pronoun comes again and again here. It all connects to param. They desire that goal. Let me paraphrase this verse. That goal which knowers of the Veda call aksharam, that goal which sannyasis, being free from desire, they enter into that goal. They pursue that goal. That goal desiring which goal, people practice brahmacharya. They desiring to reach that goal. Some people live a life of dedicated spiritual pursuit. Hey Arjuna, te, to you, tat param, that goal, pravakshye. I'm telling you this, and I'm going to continue in the coming verses. I'm going to tell you what that goal is, pravakshye, briefly, because after all, we're talking about the ultimate goal of life. So the next verses are going to discuss padam. In fact, it's going to discuss padam not as goal, but as a path to the goal. The next series of verses are going to talk about the path one takes after one's death, at the time of dying and after one's death. What path does that person take? This is what we'll see in the coming classes. We'll see those verses in the next class. And do we have any announcements today? Yeah, please. Little more. Podium.
Namaskar, Swamiji. And good afternoon, everyone. Good. I'm Chandrakala Kamat, and Lata is away on vacation, so I'll be making this announcement. As announced last Saturday, the ashram will be celebrating Deepavali